From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Right-wing extremists in the United States have always wrought hatred and violence, but rarely been targeted by government surveillance or the disproportionate media coverage reserved for terrorists of the non-white, non-Christian persuasion. But during President Donald Trump's presidency, the resurgence of armed right-wing violence and extremism is fueling fears of a new civil war. Tracing the historical roots of the myriad movements that have terrorized Americans and analyzing their tactics in a new book is my guest, Ari Perlinger. He's a professor and director of the graduate program in security studies at the School of Criminology and Justice Studies at University of Massachusetts Lowell. His many publications on political violence include Jewish Terrorism in Israel. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, American Zealots, Inside Right-Wing Domestic Terrorism. Welcome to the program, Ari.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Now, you began your research well before the rise of the political Donald Trump. And I imagine that you might, with dismay perhaps, see that your book has become so much more relevant than perhaps you might have foreseen. It seems as though, from reading your book, the landscape is actually more complicated than we think. There's so many different threads of different groups. There are many of them are localized. Some of them are more national. They're regional. There's history. And you spend almost a good half of your book on the history. I think most of us would identify the KKK as being one of the main historical origins of racist, armed, right-wing violence in the U.S., right? How do you place the KKK in the history of American right-wing domestic terrorism?
So, you are correct. Really, one of the things that I'm really trying to do is to provide a broad historical overview of the evolution of the American far right throughout the years. And it was really important for me to convey to the reader the fact that there's really significant ideological differences between the different components of them of the violent American far right. When we're talking about the KKK, we're talking about one component of a violent far right in the United States, components that usually includes the more traditional white supremacy groups, the KKK, its various branches, some of the more traditional neo-Nazi organizations, as well as some skinheads organizations that are still very active here in the US. But besides these groups, we also have the emergence of the militia movement for the last 20, 30 years. We have a significant presence of far-right militias in the 90s. Their activity declined in the previous decade, but in the last few years, we see really the re-emergence of the militia movements with some very active organizations such as the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters that basically are we can describe them as a very anti-governmental organizations, organizations that really see the federal government as a substantial threat to the freedoms of Americans. And finally, we also have a stream of a fundamentalist far right. These are organizations and groups that are using a religious text to justify white supremacy ideas, to justify a racial segregation, to justify a homophobic sentiments and anti-minority sentiments. So we really have a very complex and fragmented landscape when we are talking about the American far right.
Would you agree that some of the common threads to these myriad groups is whiteness and white supremacy, Christianity, and the sort of toxic patriarchal, movements that feel as though they're under threat because women are now speaking out and have positions of power, non-cisgendered people are becoming more visible. So these sort of broad strokes, and then of course there's also the gun rights issue, these sort of broad strokes commonalities? Would you say that those are fairly strong threads through all of these movements?
Definitely. So we see when you're looking at the rhetoric of many of these movements, especially the contemporary discourse of these groups, we can see that there's a lot of emphasis on promoting misogynist, anti-feminist ideas and a concept. Many of these groups are talking about the oppression of the white male. And they see that as a byproduct of globalization, of progressive ideas, and so on and so forth. So if I'm trying to clarify that, basically they are interested in preserving what they see as the natural privileges of the white people, and especially white males. And I think one of the interesting developments is that many of these groups believe that by embracing these misogynist, anti-feminist idea, they'll be able to better recruit new members. They believe that these kind of ideas are very attractive to a lot of young white males in America. So we see them basically talking a lot about emphasizing this idea of male supremacy as a tool to enhance their recruitment efforts. And naturally, many of them are really talking very clearly about the need to restore what they believe are the privileges and the superior status of the white race. And because of that, they also oppose open immigration policies. And in general, they oppose what they see as the growing powers of the central government that try to enforce cultural changes, social changes, demographic changes. So for them, it's a very comprehensive policy that's supposed to undermine their status and their privileges, and they believe that they should fight against that, against these kind of developments.
So very recently, we've seen some very serious violence from these right-wing armed groups who have become more visible. They're more bold about showing up with weapons. They are often tolerated, if not welcomed, by police. They've actually killed people in American cities. But if you look broadly speaking, how prevalent, how serious a problem in America is armed right-wing extremist violence? Because often it just hasn't received the media attention it should have received, you know, at least since before the Trump administration. It's often been pushed under the rug. And I know in your book, you've really tabulated and statistically looked at the history, across history, just how many attacks, how much violence they're responsible for.
So I think one of the interesting things is that when I started to study the American far right around 2011, 2012, most people looked at me as someone who is dealing with something which is very marginal, very insignificant. But what I felt is that, especially after the election of our first African-American president, I felt that there's really a significant increase in the activity of these far-right groups, especially the white supremacy groups, many of the skinhead groups. So I felt that it's really important to study and really to try to collect actual data that will enable us to understand these dynamics. And what we see is really since 2008, there's a consistent increase in the level of violence from the far right, especially during the Obama years, but still today. And moreover, what we see is that as we're getting closer to presidential elections, usually we see increase in the level of violence, the environment become more contentious. Many members of this group see this kind of electoral competition as a zero-sum game that they must win. So we really see increase in their activities. And this is something that needs to concern us, considering that we are getting very close to elections this year. So I have all expectation to see a continuous increase in the level of violence.
Do the incidents of violence from these groups, how do they compare with the kind of terrorists Americans often picture when they hear that word, right? We have been trained to think of terrorist attacks as coming from typically a Muslim or Arab man, basically a non-white, non-Christian male. But do the incidents of violence by right-wing armed white vigilantes and armed groups, does it outweigh the violence that we've seen from some of these other non-white, non-American individuals?
Definitely. If you're looking at especially the last decade, we see that both in terms of volumes as well as in terms of number of casualties, the far right is responsible for a higher numbers of attacks as well as higher number of casualties. And by the way, this active something which was part of Americans' perceptions for a long time until the last decade or so, most Americans, when they were thinking about terrorism, they were thinking about a foreign policy problem. The perceptions of many Americans was that when we're talking about terrorism, we're talking about that happens in other countries, that terrorism is usually happens in other countries or being perpetrated by foreign organizations. Violent acts by political groups from the far right usually were considered some kind of a hate crimes, or we use different designations. We are much more reluctant to categorize these acts as terrorism, something that really changed in the last few years as more and more academics as well as policy people acknowledge the fact that what we see is truly domestic terrorism. And many of these groups, their activity, their violence really fit our common definitions of terrorism in the sense that they want to promote political goals. There was to use violence in order to terrorize the public and so on and so forth. So I think this is one of the most significant changes that we've seen both within the American public, but also within our government, the more willingness to understand that this is a significant threat that truly may undermine American democracy, can undermine the trust that people have in their governments, as well as the trust and the stability of our democracy. And if you ask me, I'm much more concerned about terrorism that is really is originating from within, from our society, than something which is coming from other places, because this is really something that is violence that is perpetrated by Americans against Americans. And these kind of internal conflicts really have the potential to destabilize our political system, erode the trust that people have in the democratic system, and eventually really create more divisions and more significant polarization.
Since the September 11th attacks, our government has spent so much money, so much time, so much effort in, just setting aside the wars that we fought outside of the U.S., but the amount of money into surveillance, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security to, ensure that terrorists don't destroy the country or perpetrate attacks. How much surveillance, how seriously has the U.S. government taken armed right-wing white vigilantes? Even historically, we've seen the U.S. government, the FBI, surveil and target black civil rights organizations or black power groups, the Black Panther Party. Have they done that same sort of thing to groups like the KKK? Have they infiltrated and surveilled the domestic terrorist groups that are armed, white, vigilante, Christian, male-dominated with the same enthusiasm?
So naturally, America, especially on U.S. soil, have constitutional protections than foreign terrorist organizations or a foreign activists of terrorist organizations. So natural governments are more limited in terms of the means that they can use in order to fight domestic terrorism. In this context, you really see a growing, more and more voices arguing that we need to develop a legal mechanism that will allow us to really designate these domestic groups as terrorist organizations so we can use our anti-terrorism legislation against these groups. I think I'm a bit more skeptic about this legal mechanism. I think, especially in the American context, designating a specific organization as a terrorist organization, I'm not sure how helpful it will be, because these organizations are really are very dynamic, very fluid. They change their names, they change their structure very quickly many times. They split and merge. So it's much more difficult to use legal mechanisms against them. What we do need to do, however, is really to understand how they are able to utilize contemporary technology to radicalize young people, to radicalize youth, how they can really tap into the emotions and the attitudes of young people in the US and are able basically to bring them to the fold of their very toxic and extremist ideology. So we really need to understand the processes that leads to the radicalizations of young people into these groups, and how we can create an environment that will be less conducive to this kind of radicalization, and especially in specific parts of the country. And I think that a part of it is finding ways to also reduce the growing political polarization that exists in this country, especially in the political arena. And the fact that so many Americans completely delegitimize the other political side, or are not willing to engage in any kind of discourse, whether with the rival political, creates a breeding ground to the emergence of very radical, very militant groups. So it's really a much more broader process that needs to be implemented, that hopefully will make it more difficult for these groups to operate, to engage in illegal and violent activities, and to recruit new members. There's no other way but to think in long terms of how we can create really a social mechanism that will reduce the racial and political tensions in the country, and will enable us to engage in much more effective discourse to bridge these political gaps.
My question was more about whether the U.S. government has taken as seriously armed right-wing white vigilante terrorism as they have taken seriously non-white groups.
We do see transition in the last few years. In the last 3, 4, 5 years, we do see more and more resources which are being diverted in order to deal with domestic groups.
Even under Trump?
Especially from the far right.
Even under Trump, do we see this?
I think it's important to distinguish between the people in the field and you know, the administration's views. From my work with law enforcement, both on the federal level and the state level, and as someone who is doing this for a long time, I definitely feel that in the last 5, 6, 7 years, there's a growing understanding of the significance of this threat, and the willingness to streamline more resources to deal with threat of white supremacy groups, of militia groups, of anti-government groups, and eventually you see that also in the numbers of indictment, in the numbers of legal procedures against these groups. And in general, also the desire of law enforcement agencies to work with us, with academics who study these groups, in order to gain a better understanding of their nature.
So we know for sure that even under Trump, FBI Director Christopher Wray has admitted that, albeit reluctantly, it seems that white armed vigilantes are a bigger threat, or the biggest threat of violence. Let's talk about the tactics that these groups use, which you spend a lot of time in your book examining. Perhaps the most dramatic example that we can, you know, those of us who are, you know, our age can think of is the 1995 attack on the Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh. What are the sorts of tactics that you found these groups rely on? I mean, certainly they are ardent Second Amendment fanatics, and so it seems as though they tend to stockpile weapons. Are they preparing for a war?
Oh, definitely. Especially when we're talking about the militia movement and the various militia groups, a part of their ideological framework is the belief that the federal government is a very intrusive entity that is aiming to eventually undermine their constitutional rights. And many of them believe eventually that at some point they'll need to resist that by force. This is why they are training. This is why they collect ammunition and weapons. And I won't get into all the details of their conspiracy theories, but they do believe that eventually the federal government will be taken over by foreign entities, by foreign agents, and then they'll need to fight in order to preserve what they define as the American way of life. So in their eyes, they truly believe that that some kind of a significant clash is unavoidable. This is also related to the growing presence of the acceleration ideology or acceleration. Sorry for my pronunciation. The idea that eventually we'll see the eruption of a civil war, which will enable them to exploit this civil war to basically restore the traditional American way of life with the specific privileges to the white people and specific privileges to specific segments of society, and restore what they believe are the original values and practices and norms of America. So they have a very idealized perception that eventually we'll see this progression towards a grand civil war. And some of them are very clear about the fact that they engage in all these activities in order to escalate the tension, to escalate the situation, in order to expedite this process that will lead us eventually to a civil war. So I do think we need to take these things seriously. Another important point that I want to emphasize is that many of these militia groups includes a significant portions of veterans of former law enforcement, which is important for two reasons. First of all, that means that their members have significant operational or military experience.
Right.
Secondly, because of their background, that means that it's easier for them to mobilize support and to gain trust and to gain legitimacy, right? Mm-hmm. So this is really the concerns with regard to these groups. If we are talking in general about the violence, we see, and I talk about that in my book, we see a dramatic increase in attacks against religious sites, as well as anti-religious, mainly anti-Islamic, Islamophobic rhetoric. So we also see some fluctuation and overall increase in the violence against LGBTQ communities. And so we do see that there's a specific transition into specific type of targets that are becoming more and more popular among these groups.
Finally, Ari, I want to kind of touch on what you were saying earlier, which is looking at the long-term approach to dealing with this issue. I mean, you know, it can't just be about law enforcement. Also, especially given what you just said about the links between law enforcement and some of these groups, it really has to be about some sort of ideological shift. And I'm wondering if we can just end our conversation talking about the process of radicalization. Certainly social media and what it thrives on feeds the polarization and feeds the toxic conspiracies and other things that give rise to these groups. But, you know, do you feel that the rise of the Trump presidency has awakened the racism that was already and the patriarchy that was already existing? Or does a leader like Trump successfully, effectively influence and stoke the kind of hatred that we see now, you know, and make something out of not necessarily nothing, but, you know, make something much more than we had before? That Trump's presidency has really fueled the rise of white supremacist terrorism.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think we see that on, you know, through several dimensions. For example, you know, some of the conspiracy theory that were part of the text that these groups produced 10 years ago are now much more mainstream. You know, when I listen to mainstream political officials talking today about some of these ideas, I'm thinking, wow, these are things that I was able to read 10 years ago, just in the writings of the most extreme white supremacy groups. So we see really changes in the language and the rhetoric, and more conspiracy theories are becoming much more mainstream. And this is also related to the fact that the current environment provide much more legitimacy to many of these ideological tropes and ideological sentiments. If 10 years ago, 15 years ago, people were much less willing to admit that they have some positive sentiments towards these ideas, today they are much more open about that. They are much more empowered. And when you feel that your ideology have more legitimacy, whether it's more legitimacy from the political elites or from the public, you are more willing to go and engage in radical political activism, including violent activities, because you have this sense of empowerment that people are really behind you and are supportive of what you do. And that creates this kind of an environment that facilitates this kind of violence. We see a lot of racist violence, which is almost spontaneous in the sense that people are not planning it, but they are eventually involved in this kind of violent act because they really feel that it's legitimate now. It's there's popular legitimacy for it. They feel that they have this a moral imperative to engage in this kind of violence, and this is something that is really concerns, because if the discourse and the language that is used by our political leaders will continue to legitimize these kind of sentiments of hate, of racism, of xenophobia, of exclusiveness, eventually that spill over to the public, which feel more empowered to express that in its daily lives. So they'll go to the streets with their guns, they'll engage in various activities that will promote these ideas. So there's definitely a clear association between what we hear from our political leaders and what eventually we see in the streets.
Well, Ari, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Ari Perlegar. He's a professor and director of the Graduate Program in Security Studies at the School of Criminology and Justice Studies at University of Massachusetts Lowell. His many publications on political violence include Jewish Terrorism in Israel. We've been discussing his new book, American Zealots: Inside Right-Wing Domestic Terrorism. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.